Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the White House Blogger Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session with instructions being given at that time. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star, then zero. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Jesse Lee. Please go ahead.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for getting on relatively short notice. You know, as I'm sure you know, the president released his budget today. It kicks off a pretty long process ultimately, but we kind of wanted to touch base with everybody right at the outset here. Dave Plouffe is in a high-level meeting, to say the least, but we're hoping he can catch up with us. But in the meantime, we've got Ken Bayer from OMB, who's been as immersed in this as anybody has. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to him. He can kind of give the quick overview and then take a few questions. Ken, you want to take over?
Yeah, thanks, Jesse. Thanks, everybody, for getting on. I'll just review a bit about this budget. You know, we believe that the theory behind this budget is that to win the future, we have to out-educate, out-build, out-innovate the world so we can grow our economy and create jobs. And to do that, a key part of that is also not passing on a mountain of debt to our children and grandchildren, that we have to start living within our means so we can invest in our future. And so in this budget, we make some tough choices to cut spending, cut deficits, and put the nation on a path towards fiscal sustainability now, which will then enable us as a down payment to tackle the challenges in the long term. I think it's important to understand, and I think people often are not, you know, the chatter, they are not grasping, you know, the enormity of the hole we're in and from what the president inherited. We're at deficits this year and about 10% of GDP. And the president pledged when he took office that he would cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term. This budget puts us on a plan to do that, continue to make that pledge. And more important is it will put us in a path so far in the middle of the decade, about 2015, 2016, we'll get to the point where the government is paying for what it spends. We no longer are adding to our debts as a share of the economy. And that's the first step you need to do when you have a lot of debt. And if you're charging a lot on your credit card, the first thing you have to do is to stop adding to it and start living within your means, and then you can work on a plan to start paying it down in the future. It's in economics, it's called primary balance, and this is really the first place where you need to go. And you need to not just reach it 1 year, but you need to get there and be on a path to keep it sustainable for years to come. And our budget does that. It gets us in that range of sustainability and continues it out for the rest of the budget window for the decade. How do we do that? Part of it is how we do it is a five-year freeze on annual domestic spending, technically called non-security discretionary spending, that reduced the deficit by more than $400 billion over the next decade. That will bring this category of spending to the lowest level since Eisenhower sat in the Oval Office. The budget also includes more than 200 terminations, reductions, and savings that total more than $33 billion for this year alone. Let me just pause on that for a second. To get this type of savings from this part of the budget, it means moving beyond just cutting waste, fraud, and abuse, things that are duplicative or outdated. It really starts getting to stuff that are core priorities, things that programs that we would not cut if we're not for the fiscal situation. And there are examples of that, and I'm sure there's been a lot of discussion about that, whether it's the Community Development Block Grant or the LIHEAP program, which provides assistance to low-income people for heating and energy bills, to community action agencies, which is a group of community organizations, which, you know, frankly, are close to the president's heart when he started, as you know, as a community organizer. We're going to make tough choices to, you know, cut back some of these programs, and there's some reasons why they were chosen. We can get into that later. But again, that's in this area, but it's not like we just focused on this area. There's shared sacrifice throughout the budget. If you look in defense spending, we bring it down by $78 billion over the next 5 years relative to just the plan they released last year for the 5 years. And we cut weapons programs that Secretary Gates and his generals say we don't need, such as the C-17 tanker, the alternative engine, the Joint Strike Fighter, and the Marine Expeditionary Vehicle. In addition, there's also some cuts as well to beyond just this discretionary spending in getting into mandatory programs and as well as focusing in some areas which aren't necessarily ones that get the most headlines, but are actually incredibly important. So, for instance, for the past several years, every year, both Democrats and Republicans have voted to prevent about a 30% decrease in physician payments in Medicare to keep them in the system to see patients. And every year, we basically just put on our credit card. Well, this year, we propose $16 billion in real offsets, specific offsets in healthcare spending, in order to pay for this for 2 years. This builds on the year that we did last year for the first time, and this is a really fiscally responsible way to start reducing spending in this area. Similarly, the alternative minimum tax. Each year, Congress and whoever the president is decide that we're going to put a patch in so this tax does not hit middle class and middle income families. This is very expensive, and we identified we said, you know what, we have to pay for this. We can't just also keep putting on the national credit card. And so we have a 3-year patch on the alternate minimum tax. It's the longest paid for extension ever proposed for this proposal. And the way we're paying for it is by saying, for the high income taxpayers who itemize their deductions, they're going to bring their rate of deduction back down to where it was in the Reagan administration, to the 28%, which is the second highest bracket. So that would mean that no longer as it is right now, that a millionaire gets more of a reward for making a dollar contribution to charity versus someone who's in middle income, a teacher or a salesperson. So that is that's an important change. In addition, there's about reform throughout the budget, changing how Washington does business. We're putting more federal funding up for competition. We're cutting waste. We also have a proposal to reorganize government focusing first around making the country more competitive. So, this is a budget which is responsible. It's achievable, we believe. It charts a path for us to start get us to fiscal sustainability, and it cuts spending, more importantly, also cuts our deficit, what we need to do going forward, and we believe, is that we need to work with both sides in Congress to get this done, and hopefully we'll find some people on the Hill who want to extend their hand and join us in moving forward responsibly, so we can invest in what helps us grow and cut what doesn't. So that's a brief overview. There's a lot of details in here. Jesse, if some people want to ask, get some more details, I can dive into them the best I can.
Yeah, Chris, could you let folks know how to ask questions?
Sure. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your phone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question or comment, please press star 1 at this time. And our first question comes from the line of Chris Bowers with Daily Cost. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I have a quick question. Shared sacrifice seems to be one of the major themes in the rollout of your budget proposals. And I'm wondering what sacrifices Americans with incomes over $250,000 will have to make.
Yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, as I mentioned, the reducing the rate at which they can itemize itemize deductions. So mortgage interest payments, donations to charity. That's a significant change in the tax code. So that's one that is there. Among other sort of loophole closures and stuff, depending on what people's industry is. But specifically in this budget, we do not raise taxes on people below 250. So any sort of revenue which is raised on the individual side will touch people in that tax bracket.
Okay. As a follow-up, though, those proposals are all there. But we've already seen how difficult it is to end tax breaks for the wealthy, while it's comparatively easy to cut funding for programs that help lower-income Americans. Given that Republicans now control Congress, or at least the House of Representatives, don't you think it's likely that these tax cuts will be defeated, that these tax increases will be defeated, but the other cuts will largely stay intact?
Well, listen, this is our proposal. And we need to start having a conversation with Congress, and we'll this process just started, and we'll see what happens. No one knows the end of the story. But I would just say is, let's just look back, not even to history, real far history, but just very recent history. In December, I think, coming out of November's elections, no one really thought there'd be any room for compromise. We'd be able to, find a way to prevent a tax increase, and as well as to extend UI benefits, to get a lot of tax refundability for low-income Americans. And we were able to work with Congress and do that. So our hope is that we'd be able to could move forward together and get a responsible package passed.
Next question comes from the line of Susan Madrick with Crooks and Liars. Please go ahead.
I'm going to follow up to what Chris said. When you're talking about shared sacrifice, I mean, clearly the working and middle class is getting a disproportionate slam everywhere they turn with this budget. And you're talking about a few what sound like token items to the rest of us out here. And I'm wondering how you rationalize that during the severe economic recession.
Yeah, I take issue with that. I don't think that's the case at all. There are some programs which have gotten a lot of attention, partly because for different reasons they were previewed before the entire budget goes out. But I'd urge you to look more carefully, and you'll see that, for instance, not only do you have the tax provisions from the deal in December, extending tax credits, the child dependent care tax credit is extended, the earned income tax credit is extended. These all go to middle and low-income people. Another thing, which we do, is that we have a fund that we put money into the Department of Labor to help states experiment with paid family leave. For instance, we have lots of money. We have a very robust proposal to strengthen unemployment insurance to make sure that system is up and running, is strong for the future, both in early childhood education. There's, robust funding because, again, this is not across-the-board cuts. These are targeted cuts that we look at what's going to serve us, enable us to out-educate, innovate, not build our competitors looking forward, but also are consistent with our values. So while there are reductions, let's say, in some programs like CDBG or CSBG, we also have more than $2.5 billion in HUD alone towards our goal to end homelessness, for instance, and that is one area which we are robustly funding, for instance, that will enable HUD to assist about 78,000 additional homeless individuals and families. Also very aggressive on WIC and access to nutritious foods and combating hunger. So I understand there's, I would ask and I actually urge people to go to budget.gov. We have a whole bunch of fact sheets up that kind of break out. It's hard to find all these details in sort of easy form, different categories of interest and of spending and investments, so people can look and learn about stuff that interests them.
And our next question comes from the line of Matt Osborne. I'm getting a lot of feedback from his line.
Excuse me. I'll take it off
paper phone. Mr. Osborne?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, but we're getting some feedback.
Just a moment, please. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. I recently visited a help center operated by 43 area churches in Northwest Alabama. A video about this is on the front page of my website. The center opened at 8 o'clock, and by 8:09, all the appointments for heating assistance requests were taken. The people in the social services agencies reported a new wave of formerly middle-class Americans depending on social services and charity for the first time in their lives. Why is the White House cutting heating assistance programs from its budget when the best they can do is never, ever enough? How does that work?
I didn't catch your name or your site, so I'm really interested in seeing your story. Listen, LIHEAP is an example of a program which is a very tough choice for us to make in order to cut. The fact is that for many years it was at a level of funding roughly around $2.5 billion a year. It was a program which is not going to meet all need, but it's just going to meet around that level of need. And in 2008, we all remember that summer there was a very intense spike in energy prices. So at that time, the program was basically doubled. And so looking at that, since then, energy prices have come down from that level. So looking at it, looking at the tough, now analyzing where we could find savings, but also make a tough choice, we said, you know, maybe that's a program which not necessarily has to be sustained at this level, which it just was for not even, you know, 2 years. And so we chose to bring that back. I'm not going to lie to you, it's not an easy choice for us to have made, but it's the type of tough choice that we had to make and that you have to do if you want to start getting our fiscal situation in order.
This is Jesse. I think David Plouffe just jumped on too. David, if you want to say anything on that, in general, some of the questions have been whether we think the budget actually does have shared sacrifices both amongst low and high income people. So if you want to make up any ground, by all means, go ahead.
Well, thanks, Jesse, and I apologize for being late, everyone. Well, I think, as Ken was just saying, obviously, this is a budget that has a lot of tough decisions and choices in it. As the president said today, the programs that he believed are very important that we've had to reduce. But it is a general framework, as he laid out in the State of the Union, that reflects his view about how we're going to win the future and grow the economy. And, obviously, even in a tough budget situation, this starts with, an assessment of whether you think, we do need to bend the fiscal curve here and believe that we have to get to a more sustainable deficit level. And the president does believe that. If folks don't, obviously, you wouldn't make some of these same decisions. But in order to do that, which he thinks is an important priority, so that we can invest smartly in places like education, like innovation, research and development, high-speed internet, infrastructure projects around the country. I think the president's belief is you need to have a sort of theory of how you're going to grow economically and have the kind of jobs that will support families all around the country. And so his belief is that now's the wrong time to retreat in terms of those investments in education, innovation, research, and development. So as part of that, obviously, you're going to have to make some tough choices elsewhere. And that's really what he unveiled today. And obviously, this is the beginning of a process. And obviously, there's going to be some ideas, primarily from folks in the other party, that not only, in terms of women's health care, in terms of the environment, in terms of children, nutrition programs, but also in terms of education, in R&D, in energy development, you're going to see some really, really severe proposals. And so this is going to be a process to see if we can arrive at, a place where, the president's belief that while we do have to do some really tough things from the deficit side, and there's no doubt this does that, that we still keep a firm eye fixed in the areas that are going to create the jobs of the future. And that's what I think this budget reflects. So, Jesse, we'd be happy to, take more questions, obviously.
Our next question comes from the line of David Dayan with FDL News. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my question. I guess I'll make it for both Mr. Baer and Mr. Plouffe. I want to focus on the present. I know we've talked a lot about the future. Where does the administration think demand will come from to reverse this very large three-year demand shortfall if you cut budgets in the immediate term at a time when 14 million people are unemployed, state budgets are contracting, trade is still in imbalance, and corporations are sitting on $2 trillion in cash? And actually, to make that more of a political question, no president has ever run for re-election with unemployment over 7.8%. The budget predicts unemployment at the end of 2012 at 8.2%. Is it worth reducing aggregate demand at this time when the political benefit is facing re-election with the highest unemployment in recorded history?
Well, obviously, the employment estimates are conservative. We certainly hope so. And obviously, we've seen over the last year, a lot of positive trajectory in terms of job growth. It's not nearly enough, obviously. And we have to continue to see growth at a certain level to produce the kind of jobs we need. I think that, obviously, this budget, as the president has said repeatedly, as we try and bring down spending and reduce the deficit, we can't jeopardize the recovery. And I think a lot of thought was put into by Ken and by Jack, by the president and others, to make sure that it's a budget that does not have the negative effects on the economy in terms of hiring, in terms of growth. And, you know, obviously we're seeing some pretty encouraging signals out there in terms of potential hiring, in terms of potential wage growth. So I think this is a budget that, while it does obviously have some tough cuts in here and does eliminate some programs, it nourishes the areas that we think are going to be so very important, not just in the long term, because you're right, you know, obviously research and development, education, those do pay dividends in the long term, but also in the short term. And so, Ken, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I just add, you know, two things. One is that these proposals, we're talking about fiscal year 2012, which is a bit away, far away, and hopefully the economy will be stronger and kind of building on momentum it has now. Secondly is, and then some of these proposals are also constructed in a way so they don't start going into effect a little bit later. And contrasting that to the debate that we're seeing on Capitol Hill, where the cuts they're doing for 2011 will start March 5th if they get their way. And those will have actually, there is a risk there that could have to where we are now. Secondly, I'd say is that we do realize that there's a short-term, long-term thing here. We are investing for the future. At the same time, since December in particular, but also over the past, you know, several months, the president has been taking a series of steps in order to keep the recovery going and keep economic growth going, keeping and spurring job creation. The tax deal that in December was one of them, which both, for instance, cut payroll taxes for 159 million workers, working Americans, and for a typical family, just an extra $1,000 in their pocket, which should boost macroeconomic demand right now. That's just one of many tax increases. The 100% expensing provisions, as well as the R&D tax credit extension, should hopefully do that for business. Similarly, on trade, the president has moved forward and made an agreement on the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, which is a very growing economy, an important economy for us, but also it's an agreement which, you know, has high standards for workers' rights in it as well, showing that we can do both. And then finally, as I mentioned before, in our proposal for infrastructure, for surface transportation authorization, we want to do an upfront investment of $50 billion, which would jumpstart additional job creation right now in a shorter time frame than the usual longer time frames you have for a transportation bill.
And our next question comes from the line of Sam Stein with the Huffington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. I think I speak for everyone when I say that, Ken, we were not disappointed when you were on first and David was asked. I want to ask a question about what's not in the budget, primarily any reforms to Social Security that would have mimicked what the Deficit Commission proposed. Is this fair to interpret as a sign that massive reform to the entitlement program is off the table for the next 2 years at least, or should we not be surprised if you guys were to back supplemental legislation to reform the system?
Well, Sam, as the president said in the State of the Union, he views Social Security primarily as an issue about shoring it up for the long term as opposed to a deficit issue. So, and we talked a lot about this as far back as the campaign, but very clear that, if there are proposals out there that are acceptable, that don't, reduce benefits, don't slash benefits, that don't affect current retirees, the president's open to proposals that would shore the system up in the long term. And I think, Ken, we had some language in the budget that reflected that in addition to the comments we made at the State of the Union. And listen, obviously, the discretionary spending is just part of this. $78 billion in Department of Defense cuts were part of this budget. And so I think the president in the State of the Union was pretty clear that this budget is a strong foundation, an important spark to get us on the right fiscal path. But obviously, the health care reform that was passed is going to save us $1 trillion in terms of the deficit. Which is for those that want to repeal it, obviously, it'd be interesting to find how they're going to find $1 trillion in deficit reduction savings. But obviously, healthcare spending continues to put a lot of fiscal pressure on the federal government, on states. So, the president's open to working with Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate on some of these ideas. So, but this is a process, obviously, and I think what the president laid out today is a very, very smart and balanced approach to make sure that we can invest in the areas like education, like innovation, like infrastructure, that we need to create jobs and continue to grow economy, while making sure that we are more responsible about the fiscal path our country's on.
Thank you, and we'll next go to the line of Jed Lewison with Daily Cost. Please go ahead.
Thanks, guys, for doing this call. My question is, I was looking over the budget document and on the table that lists outlays by budget enforcement category on page 145. If you look at the discretionary spending and the non-defense discretionary spending since 1962, I mean, just by eyeballing it, it looks like that other than the period from 1981 to 1983, there's never been a significant sustained reduction in non-defense discretionary spending, and this budget proposal is calling for a fairly substantial cut over a five-year period of time. And I'm just wondering sort of what makes you think that's realistic or possible?
I don't have – would you know what table number is that, if I could take a look at with you?
Page 165.
Okay. I don't actually think maybe looking at
145.
Maybe we're looking at different volumes. I don't think I have that volume in front of me. I have a different one. But I would just say in general, as you know, these are our proposals, and it's up to, you know, these discretionary funds are allocated, appropriated every year by the Congress and signed law by the President. This is our policy is to have this freeze, and we want to work with Congress to put it into effect. And, that is our hope, and hopefully we'll do it together. Hopefully we can find people, partners on Capitol Hill, both sides of the aisle, to work together in order to, live within our means, so as well as invest in our future.
Thank you. And next we'll go to the line of Christina O'Connell with Fire Dog Lake. Please go ahead.
Thanks, and thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious, you mentioned a few minutes ago that there is a cut in defense spending. However, the Wall Street Journal says that the new request is $22 billion above the currently appropriate levels. The request is higher than was requested before, I think by at least some numbers of billions. In addition, there is a overseas contingency operations fund of $118 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan, and I gather also Pakistan. Could you explain, since that number is both where the cut is that you mentioned, and then on this overseas contingency operations funding, since that is lower than has been previously spent year on year, can you rule out supplementals for additional funding?
Well, let me take that. When we came to office, the president wanted to have a budget which is more honestly reflected how we're spending money. So the previous administration would assume, for instance, zero overseas contingency operations, which is a nice way of saying war costs, looking out into the future. And we came in and they would just do supplementals. And so you'd say, well, you know, in 2 years from now, for instance, it would cost $0. And then, you know, 6 months later, you would then pass $80 billion, whatever it is, as a supplemental to pay for your operations abroad. We said that's not the way to go. And so we wanted to put all those costs on the budget. So we want to use supplementals if we had to in the case of when you actually need to have an emergency sort of request. If there was a fundamental change of strategy or some environment or some new threat and you needed more money to respond to what you were planning for, that's the use for supplemental, not to pay for operations which you know are ongoing. The overseas contingency operations budget, we kind of break it out here this year. It's a new thing, and there's actually a separate chapter in the budget on there because we think it's important to bring a level of transparency to defense and security budgeting, which didn't exist before. So too often what happened is you have increases in a security department like the Defense Department almost always for these operations, and all of a sudden people start thinking that's the new base, and these operations become part of their base budget. And that's not the right way of looking at it. And it also leads to, you know, basically spending kind of getting increasing beyond what you wanted. And so instead, in this way, you're able to see how, for instance, if you look at the budget, you'll see a very, very strong, easily understandable chart which shows that significant reductions, I believe in the neighborhood of $40 billion, in Defense Department spending in this category, and a slight increase in this actually, it's a $41 billion decrease in overseas contingency operations, and Department of State and USAID increased by $3 billion. And that is a significant, because that shows that reflects the drawdown in Iraq. So overall, OCO is what they call it, on budgeting terms, funding is $30 billion than what we requested in 2011. And again, and driving that is a very significant reduction in what we're spending in DOD for those type of operations.
All right, moderator, let's take one more question if we've got it. And
great, that's what I have, one more.
Well, there you go.
That's from Emily Guess with On Earth Magazine. Please go ahead.
Hi, Emily Gertz. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the allocation of monies under the Department of Energy for non-fossil fuel investment. I wondered why the strong emphasis on nuclear energy, which appears to be getting more as an energy source than any other single type of non-fossil energy. Given that many of these alternative energies are, closer to deployment, from the start of a project to the end than it would be to build a nuclear power plant, if the goal is to cut carbon emissions and other kinds of air pollution, I just wondered why the allocation.
Well, Ken, before you get specific, I would just say broadly, the president has said often that to achieve our energy independence goals, we're going to have to use all sorts of different kinds of energy. And, some nuclear is a part of that, obviously, programs to reach a cleaner coal and ultimately clean coal part of that. In addition to biofuels, which, this is obviously an area of the budget generally in terms of energy and R&D related energy that gets a lot of attention. And something that the president's put a lot of focus on. So, a lot of investment in this budget in terms of biofuels, in terms of more solar, in terms of continuing to move towards, more electric vehicles on the road. So I think the president's view has been that to reach our energy independence goals as quickly as we need to, we're going to have to really utilize a lot of different energy sources. And, and I think that, this budget reflects that approach. But this is, I think, a very, very important. I mean, this is a very, very important, not just in terms of what it means in terms of the environment, but obviously, if we are going to remain and grow economically, it's going to be because we, from a technology standpoint, from a research standpoint, are leading the world in these areas. And obviously, I think this has been an area, the president talked a lot about this during the campaign in the 2 years since. We did not spend as much time and energy and resources focusing on this as we should have done over the last generation. And in many respects, we fell behind some other countries. And so I think this budget reflects the president's urgent belief that one of the key drivers of our economy in the years to come is going to be us really leading the way in some of these breakthrough technologies. And I think this budget reflects his passion and belief in really spending effort and resources and leadership to make sure that we're doing all we can to create a pathway to energy independence, as well as the millions of jobs that will be created in these industries.
I would just add to that just on the specifics that I'm sure you may know more about clean energy in particular than I do. There's some things which may be a little complicated to look in the budget. I'm happy if you should get your contact info from Jesse. If you want to, Jesse, will tell you to get in touch with me, and we could put you in touch and make sure we're looking at apples to apples here. Because I'm not entirely sure that the premise is right. I think there's there's such a disproportionate amount going to nuclear as we look at our whole clean energy portfolio. But look, we should talk offline about that.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for calling in. I know it's kind of late, and thanks, Dave, and thanks, Ken, for hopping on. I know it's been a long day for both of you guys, and obviously, this will be going on for quite a while. Feel free to email me if you kind of have further questions. I'm happy to talk about it, too, and we'll be in touch.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude your call for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference Service. You may now disconnect.